spacecraft edge closer, the shuttle crew will grab Hubble with Atlantis' robotic arm. Former astronaut Lauren Shriver launched Hubble from Shuttle Discovery in 1990. He says the telescope is 350 miles up, far higher than the space shuttle normally goes.
So comparing that altitude and the scenery, you can see, again, the panoramic view that's down below you was even that just that much better.
Spacewalkers will attempt to replace a broken computer on Hubble tomorrow. For NPR News, I'm Pat Duggins in Orlando.
The National Transportation Safety Board is continuing an investigation of a deadly plane crash last February. A commuter plane crashed into a home near Buffalo, killing 50 people aboard. The board has already learned the pilot had failed several aviation tests. Today, the board has looked into whether the co-pilot may have been overtired. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News in Washington.
Support for NPR comes from the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, committed to building a more just, verdant, and peaceful world. More information at macfound.org.
News from NPR is made possible by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, offering pinch-proof doors, keyless digital entries, and lifetime manufacturer's warranties. Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families with professionally installed doors and automatic openers since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
Hi, I'm Kevin Kelly. The Wednesday edition of Live and Local will feature two events involving young people in our communities. My guests will be Robert Smith, whose students at Booker T. Washington School in Champaign will perform Willy Wonka Kids, and Tricia Stiller, who co-directs the McLean County Diversity Project's production of The Laramie Project in Bloomington. It's Live and Local, weekdays from noon to 1 on FM 90.9.
Good morning. This is Focus 580, our morning talk program, hour number two of the show. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you listening. The producers for our program, Harriet Williamson and Martha Deal, Henry Frain is at the controls this morning. In early January, Pat Quinn, then the Lieutenant Governor of Illinois, set up the Illinois Reform Commission to examine the workings of state government and to look for ways to root out corruption. Now, that committee has made a number of recommendations in the areas of campaign finance, in procurement, and transparency, and that remains to be seen what, if anything, the legislature will do with these recommendations. There are some reports in the media that it's possible that as soon as next week, the Senate might actually be voting on some legislation based on the recommendations of the Reform Commission. We wanted to take a little bit of time here this morning to talk about the commission, talk about some of their recommendations, and give folks an opportunity to ask questions, make comments. And we're fortunate that we have as our guests this morning two members of the commission, Patrick Collins, who chairs the commission, and Lawrence Oliver. Let me tell you just a little bit more about them. In addition to their activities with the commissions, they both are attorneys. Mr. Collins was, in fact, an assistant U.S. attorney for 12 years in Chicago, last four of which were as the deputy chief of the public corruption section. And during his time there, he was involved in several high-profile, highly successful investigations, including he playing the lead role in the hired truck and Operation Safe Road investigations. And in fact, in 2006, he led the government's team in the six-month trial and conviction of former Illinois Governor George Ryan. Lawrence Oliver is the chief counsel in the investigations division for the Boeing Company. He served as assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago from 1998 until 2003, and he was involved in investigating and prosecuting a wide range of federal offenses, including fraud and drug trafficking. They're both joining us this morning by telephone, and of course, questions and comments from listeners are welcome. The only thing that we ask of people who are calling in is that they try to keep their questions and comments brief so we can keep moving along. Questions, though, certainly are welcome. Here in Champaign-Urbana, the number 333-9455. And we also do have a toll-free line. That one is good anywhere that you can hear us. So if it would be a long-distance call, use that number. Calls on us. That's 800-222-9455. So again, here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455. Toll-free, 800-222-9455, and questions and comments are certainly welcome. Mr. Collins, hello.
Good morning. How are you?
I'm fine, thank you. And Mr. Oliver.
Hi, David.
Thank you both very much for giving us some of your time. We appreciate it. And I do also want to mention that if people are interested in reading more about the commission and reading in detail the recommendations that you have made, there is a website that is www.reformillinoisnow.org. www.fokus580.org so that it can find all of that there. One thing I think I would like to do to start, and perhaps I'll start and I'll pose this question to Mr. Collins, perhaps you could just talk a little bit about the charge that was given to the commission when it was set up by Governor Quinn, now Governor Quinn, then Lieutenant Governor Quinn.
Sure. I basically got a call in late December after the governor had been arrested, and in the midst of a lot of the, you know, national talk shows making fun of Illinois, and Lieutenant Governor Quinn called me and said that he believed we were in the midst of an integrity crisis and asked if I would bring together a group of folks and chair a commission to propose reforms to state government and to do it, you know, on an expedited basis. I'm a lawyer now in private practice, but it was, you know, an interesting call to receive, and it was a challenging situation, and I accepted and immediately began to reach out to folks, some of whom I knew, some of whom I knew only by reputation, to try to put together a good, diverse group of people with very different life experiences that come together over a 100-day period and attempt to propose reforms for Illinois. We very quickly decided on six topics: transparency, campaign finance, procurement, enforcement issues, government structure, and something we call inspiring better government. And it really was over the last 100 days that we focused in depth on those issues. We had hearings all over the state. We had town hall meetings across Illinois and came together and wrote a report that we released April 28th that was really the unanimous consensus opinion of our group after hearing from a lot of experts and digesting a lot of information. And it's really that report that we've now are literally in the process of putting those into language for legislative action through the bill process. And, you know, we have a couple weeks left in the legislative session, and it's our hope and desire that these concepts, now bills or about to become bills, will get serious consideration and ultimately a vote from the members of the General Assembly.
Yeah, and this is something that certainly action has been urged editorially by the media of the state. A lot of people who are involved in good government have said they'd really like to see something happen. The governor, Governor Quinn, has said he would really like to see something happen this session. I know that you all would. Do you feel that if not a full kind of package of fully embracing the recommendations of the commission, do you think that some significant legislation and some significant change will indeed come?
Again, and I think both for Lawrence and I, you know, this is a little bit outside our element. You know, certainly that's our hope, and, mm-hmm. and frankly, it should be expected given what the state has been through. You know, we've set up what we believe is essentially, and the governor's called a blueprint for reform. We essentially think there should be a report card on these six topics. And, you know, we've sort of put in black and white, in 88 pages, perhaps too long for many folks, but, you know, we've put in black and white what we think the sort of standard should be, all of which, I might add, you know, have been tried. All these concepts that we put in this document have been tried across the country. These are not things that, you know, we made up in a room somewhere. And it really should be, you know, come May 31st, which is when the session is supposed to end, we think what should happen is whatever passes should be put up against, you know, our report to see how far we came. And look, we understand there's compromises, we understand there's negotiations, but this is the time, and Lawrence has said this more eloquently than I can, but, you know, this really is the time for change. There's been this perfect storm of events. This is a once-in-a-generation opportunity to really meaningfully reform state government, and we really shouldn't accept something less than that.
Maybe, let me turn to Mr. Oliver, and I know that Patrick Collins here talked a little bit about the process, about the fact that you spend a lot of time talking with public policy people and also, though, traveling around the state and having town meetings and encouraging citizens to talk about what they felt, and there was one here in our area as well. Can you summarize in some way what it is that you've heard from people, particularly from citizens, about this particular issue?
You know, I would say outrage would be the one word that stands out. I mean, there was a collective outrage across the state following the Blagojevich arrest, and people just feel that enough is enough, and that cuts across really all six topics that we addressed in our report. I think everybody is in tune to the role that campaign finance plays in corruption that's been played out in the last two the prior two governors, as we know. People are familiar with the pay-to-play problems that have cropped up throughout local and state government. So people were coming out and kind of uniformly voicing those concerns.
Mm-hmm. There are a number of recommendations here that we might talk about, but I think perhaps one of the things that people may well feel most strongly about has to do with campaign finance. And I think that for a long time now, people in the state of Illinois, people who are part of the good government movement, have been saying that one of the big problems that we have is that there are no limits on campaign contributions. You can raise as much as you care to. You can accept a contribution from an individual in any amount, and that it's wide open. Now, people have said that, well, we can address that by having timely reporting of contributions, and there may well be questions about how well that system works. But you, I think, all have embraced this idea of limits on contributions. What is it that you have suggested?
Well, and Lawrence and I were both on the campaign finance subgroup, and maybe I can get started and Lawrence can chime in.
Sure.
But we really took a broad brush approach to it. There is, as you were suggesting, a disclosure piece to it. I mean, right now we're in the midst of a legislative session. People are holding fundraisers. But we won't know who gave what money to which politicians and how much until July, after the legislative session is well over. And, again, in a democracy with tools of the Internet, I mean, that's just really ridiculous, because this is when the decisions are made. This is when people are attempting to influence the legislature properly or improperly, and that information should be known to the public, the media, who's given to what. So one of the things we propose as a disclosure device is, you know, if you're going to give $1,000 or more to a statewide official or $500 or more to a legislator, the legislator has 5 days to report that. And it's a commonsensical thing. It's something that happens close to elections, but it really should happen during the legislative session, and it should happen year-round. So that's one important plank, and there's a number of disclosure provisions regarding bundling and independent expenditures that might be getting into the weeds here. But we have a disclosure piece. A core part of our proposals relate to limits. I mean, as you say, there's been no limits. It is sort of the Wild West. Governor Blagojevich perhaps, you know, took it to an extreme, but, you know, there were 425 contributions of $25,000 or more that Governor Blagojevich received. And there's been reports and allegations that some of those were in return for filling, you know, seats on boards and commissions. Big money in politics is a problem. And again, I think all of us are sophisticated enough to understand you can't completely shut it off, but we have to start somewhere. And so really, I think, is a fairly modest proposal, which is to turn down the volume a little bit and put some limits, individual contribution limits that effectively match what the federal folks can do, $2,400 per person for individuals, $5,000 if you're a company or a union. And that, to me, is, again, it's commonsensical reform. It's not going to solve all the problems. There's ways around that. But at least it takes off the table some of the really aggressive fundraising tactics that really start selling our government sort of piece by piece. A third piece of this, which we think is very important, is public financing. Any serious debate about campaign finance reform has to at least talk about public finance. It's not perfect. There's 25 states that do some form of public finance. We think it's appropriate to start with the judicial branch. Lawrence and I are both lawyers, and the notion that we could give $5,000, $10,000, $20,000 to a judge in the Supreme Court or appellate court one day and appear before her the next, I mean, it's truly crazy. But the system would allow for that and does allow for that. Mm-hmm. And big money has flown in to these various judicial races. So we think public finance should be seriously considered. There are all sorts of administration issues. And what we would like to do is do a pilot project at the judicial level, work out the kinks, get administered well, funded well, and then expand that to the legislative branch and statewide offices in later years. That's a very important piece of our proposal, and frankly one that I've heard some good things from the legislators, particularly in the Senate, about their receptivity to that concept. There's things like the primary date. We think the primary date should be moved. We think that will help reduce some costs in the campaign. At a minimum, it'll just make it more appropriate in a democratic system that people are going to the polls in, you know, 60 or 70 degree weather rather than 20 degree weather in February. It makes no sense to have it in February. So, I mean, that's a broad stroke of some of the things. And, Lawrence, I don't know if I forgot anything, but those are some of our core provisions.
Yeah, and we did identify a few outright bans. One, that the lobbyists should be precluded from giving any campaign contributions, just given their role in the entire process. We've also tagged trusts just because of the kind of the mystery that surrounds the way trusts are carried out. That we've identified that through the input from experts as something that should be banned. State employees, we're recommending that what they can give be curbed as well. So those are just kind of low-hanging fruit, as we saw it, that should get an outright ban.
We have a caller. I want to get to them just a second. Let me very quickly introduce again our guests, Patrick Collins and Lawrence Oliver. They're two members of the Illinois Reform Commission. The commission was set up by Pat Quinn, who was at the time the lieutenant governor. This was in January, and their charge was to take 100 days to take a look at Illinois politics and suggest reforms. And just at the end of April, they issued a report with a series of recommendations. If you'd like to read more about the commission, like to look at what they're recommending, it's very easy to go to their website, which is www.reformillinoisnow, so that's all squeezed together, no spaces, reformillinoisnow.org, and you can take a look at what it is that they have suggested. Questions are welcome, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And we have a caller here, someone here in Urbana, where we are, line one. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
In my view, one of the big obstacles to good government in Illinois is the excess power that the Speaker of the House and the Senate Majority Leader have, and that oftentimes it seems like the two of those men and the governor are the only three players who count on matters of importance, budget and so on. Are you proposing anything that would sort of rebalance the power so that individual legislators actually can vote their conscience? Right now, the purse of the Speaker, for example, is so huge that in a contested election, his contributions will dwarf the individual contributions in an election, and in return, then he gets unfailing loyalty whenever he gives the command on how to vote on budget and these sorts of things. So are you doing anything to try to rein in the power of the Senate Majority Leader and the Speaker?
And this is Patrick, and it's a very fair question, and you know, without, you know, making it a personal thing, because it is a structural problem, and I think the caller is right. And the short answer is yes. I mean, we recommend legislative leader term limits. That is to say, if you're going to be the Speaker of the House or the President of the Senate, you should be limited to a term of 10 years. And you know, again, it makes sense, and it's not just about Speaker Madigan. I mean, Senate President Jones has been around either as a majority or minority leader for more than 10 years. Pate Phillip, you know, Lee Daniels. You know, Illinois has a tradition of, and they called it the four tops, the two tops, and it does ultimately, with this consolidation of power, it does have anti-democratic effects. So the short answer is yes on that, and we talk about legislative leader term limits. We also talk about reducing the transfers. There was a reference by the caller to the ability of the Speaker, again, it could be the Speaker, Democrat, it could be the Minority Leader, Republican. It's really a bipartisan thing, because who knows 4 years from now who's going to be in power, because those political winds shift. But what does happen in these House and Senate races, and this is something we heard firsthand at our hearings, are these large infusions of cash by leadership on both sides of the aisle for these targeted races. And it's not unusual to have $400,000, $500,000, $600,000, $700,000 pumped into these races from the leadership. And I think the caller is exactly right, and it's human nature. You know, if someone gives me $500,000 and puts me over the top, there's certainly going to be a bind there, a loyalty bind that the person feels because of how important that cash infusion was to the campaign. So those are things we definitely take on. They're ones you can imagine are not particularly popular in the halls of the General Assembly. But, you know, our role as commission was not to sort of, do the popular thing in terms of what was popular in Springfield, but it was to do the thing that will improve democracy in Illinois. And so we did take on this consolidation of power. And one related concept that we also took on, which also is not popular, is this idea of redistricting. I mean, if you compare the way Illinois draws its districts to the way Iowa, our neighbor state, does, and there are certainly demographic differences between Illinois and Iowa, but, you know, we have these gerrymandered districts in some respects to protect certain politicians, and it's just anti-democratic, and other states do it very differently, and that was one of our proposals as well, but that also gets to this issue of consolidation of power.
Well, I'm glad to hear about those proposals, and I didn't personalize this with the current speaker or majority leader, but I have just been in this state too long and seen the effects of this huge cash that's out of their pots. And it seems to me like the backbench legislators should be very enthusiastic about this, because so often now on really important matters, they're cut out of any significant role. And so hopefully they'll get behind this. But again, the question is, will the speaker allow them to support legislation which would rebalance the power in the equation?
Those are very fair observations. And again, Dwayne Noland, who's a commissioner of ours, a former senator and state senator and state house member from the Decatur Blue Mound area, you know, he was both a beneficiary of redistricting, and he also lost out on redistricting and on this issue of budgets. And he would talk about how the budgets would get dumped on their lap, you know, the evening before the vote. You know, and that's one of the most important things a legislator has to do is vote on a budget. And there weren't budget hearings. There was stuff done, you know, by leadership behind closed doors, both sides of the aisle. And then the legislators were given a budget and basically said, you know, this is what we're for. And, that's a little bit of an overstatement. But according to Dwayne, not much. And that's not democratic.
It's not. It is bad government. Thank you very much.
Thank
for your
work. I don't know, Mr. Oliver, anything that you'd want to add to all of that?
Only that the concept of term limits, to be clear, this would be what we envision a prospective application. In other words, it won't apply to the current tenure of the Senate leaders or the House leader. It would be something that would start from the time it's enacted. So the effect would not be realized for at least 10 years.
Mm-hmm. We have a couple of other callers. The number here in Champaign-Urbana, 333-9455, toll-free 800-222-9455. And again, this morning our guests are Lawrence Oliver and Patrick Collins. They are two members of the Illinois Reform Commission. At the end of April, they released their recommendations for changes in the way Illinois government operates. So they were working on this and had been given this charge by Pat Quinn, now the governor, then the lieutenant governor, to come up with a series of recommendations and to do it within 100 days. The governor has said that he hopes that something could be passed this session. We're getting down to the wire here. I think we have less than 3 weeks left in the session, and it remains to be seen just what might happen. Questions, again, are certainly welcome, 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Next, we'll talk, I believe, with somebody in Champaign, and this would be line number 3. Hello.
Good morning.
Yes.
As you perhaps know, the late columnist Mike Royko used to say that the motto of the city of Chicago should be changed from the Garden City to Where's Mine? The reason I bring that up is to what degree do you think the problems you're discussing are the product of, or at least heavily influenced by, the nature and the culture of the Chicago machine, and the influence of that end of the state versus the rest of the state? Thank you.
All right. Well, Mr. Collins, you live in Chicago. You both of you are upstate guys.
I was going to pass that one to Lawrence. But, No, look, one of the things I have to say, and this may sound naive, but one of the things, you know, we certainly learned by traveling the state is, you know, the vision that folks from central and southern Illinois and western Illinois have about Chicago. And, look, I'm not here to defend Chicago. There's been a lot of problems in Chicago, Chicago politics and government. I think it's a cultural issue, I do, but I don't think it's rooted in Chicago or people, you know, George Ryan, I don't think, had his roots in Chicago. He was obviously from Kankakee. And, I do think there's a power issue, and I think there's a cultural issue that spans state government. Perhaps it's more intense in Chicago. But, I do think it's a cultural issue, and I do think what I saw as a prosecutor and what I heard as part of a member of this commission is, you know, there's some perverse incentives being given to state employees. You know, they look around and you have two choices, you know, do your job and, you know, do it well, or maybe not do it so well, but focus on making your political sponsor happy, and are you going out knocking on doors on weekends? And, you know, state employees, when you look and you try to be rational about your job and you see how people get rewarded if they do the political stuff and they don't get rewarded if you just do your job well, you know, that seeps into the culture of the entity. And, you know, we heard from a lot of state employees who are just so sort of beaten down by this system. And, you know, if you work for a company and your last two CEOs got indicted, that would affect the morale of your entity. So I definitely think the cultural stuff has seeped into the DNA of the state, if you will. Does it have its roots in Chicago? You know, I don't know. And frankly, I'm not sure it matters. But I can't tell you it's a cultural problem, in my judgment. There was one organizational development person who called me, and one of the great things about this little 100-day mission is, you know, I've heard from all sorts of different people who have their theories, and one of the things this organizational development person told me is, you know, when you think about changing an organization, it's going to take as much time to change an organization as it did to have the organization run afoul. So in other words, if it took 20 years to sort of get this culture of corruption, it's going to take 20 years to sort of wean itself from it. And that's a sort of a sobering thought, if it's accurate for purposes of state government.
Yeah, I mean, I would only add that I would agree that the perception is certainly that the roots are in Chicago. If you look at the major public corruption federal indictments, they certainly center here. The alleged acts and the acts for which people were convicted typically occurred in this district. So you can assign to that what you wish, but certainly the perception is that. One of the things that we are trying to do in our report is spread the enforcement powers to the state's attorneys to give them more of the same tools that the federal authorities have to go after public corruption by expanding wiretap capabilities for public corruption investigation, for allowing one-party consent to have an informant wear a wire against a subject or a target, so that the federal government is not the only enforcement mechanism that we can resort to. And that, of course, would apply throughout the state to all the state's attorneys. So that is a way that we can kind of change the perception that everything is rooted here.
We have another caller, a couple of callers. Let me just pause for just a moment. I need to pass on some weather information to people who are listening. The National Weather Service in Lincoln has issued a flash flood warning for southern Champaign County. That will be in effect until 3:30 this afternoon. The Weather Service indicated slow-moving storms this morning with very heavy rainfall across the warned area. Estimates are up to 2.5 inches along Interstate 74, including the Champaign-Urbana area. Runoff from this rainfall will cause flash flooding to occur, and some of the places that will experience flooding include Champaign, Broadlands, Pasotum, Philo, Savoy, Seymour, Sydney, St. Joe, Tolono, Urbana, Ivesdale, Sedoris, and also Willard Airport. Several intersections in Champaign are reported flooded, including the intersection of Neal and Washington Streets. Excessive runoff from heavy rain will cause flooding of small creeks and streams, urban areas, highways, streets, and underpasses, as well as other drainage areas and low-lying spots. So do report any flooding to your local emergency manager or the nearest law enforcement agency. And again, this is a flash flood warning for southern Champaign County in east central Illinois that will be in effect until 3:30 this afternoon. We'll keep an eye on the weather. You do the same. The next update we'll have for you on the weather will come in just about 1 hour from now here on WILL. And again, just very quickly, let me tell you that we're talking this morning with two members of the Illinois Reform Commission. Patrick Collins, he's the chair, and Lawrence Oliver. They're both attorneys, and Mr. Collins now is in private practice in Chicago. He served as the assistant U.S. attorney for 12 years in Chicago and was involved in a number of very high-profile investigations, including the hired truck and Operation Safe Road investigations he also led in 2006, the government's team in the six-month trial and conviction of former Illinois Governor George Ryan. Lawrence Oliver is now chief counsel for investigations at the Boeing Company, has had that job since 2004. He also served as assistant U.S. attorney in Chicago from 1998 until 2003, investigating and prosecuting a range of federal offenses, including fraud and drug trafficking. And again, I would encourage people to take a look at the recommendations of the Reform Commission. They have made a number of them, and you can read their final report, which just came out at the end of April, by going to their website, which is reformillinoisnow.org. Let's take some other callers. I think we have someone here on our line number two. Hello.
Hello.
Yes.
Yes. First of all, thanks to the guests for doing some good work. I've read the summary of the recommendations, and I think I hope they're approved. My question is on a topic that I don't think I see in the recommendations. Recently, the Madigan suggested the 3,000 appointed individuals be terminated, and they might be considered for reappointment. I support that, but I think more important, we need a process for assuming that all state appointees should be done on the basis of competence and not connections or contributions. A process might be different for each type of position that's being considered, but it seems to me the process needs to be fixed so that we don't have governors making appointments based on who gave money or their connections, et cetera. I could go on and on, but in light of David's suggestion we keep it brief, I'll stop there and listen.
All right. Thanks for the question. I'll pitch it first to Mr. Oliver, and then, of course, I'm sure Patrick Collins might want to comment. What do you think?
Well, I mean, I think if you look at the Shachtman decree and the state counterpart, everybody understands that there are certain positions that are appropriately set aside for political appointments, and that the chief executive for that governmental body should have a say in certain positions. But the problem has been, as I see it, and Patrick has been closer to this with his hired truck investigation, so I'll turn it over to him briefly. But the problem is that the lines get blurry, and you get into these non-political positions. And I served on the Illinois Executive Ethics Commission for 4 years and would see this from time to time as well. That there needs to be better enforcement in these situations where we're really talking about non-political positions that should go based on merit to the most qualified candidate. So this is a ripe area for review. It's been this way for quite a while, and it's been a tough nut to crack in terms of really turning around the perceived practices.
Well, I am particularly interested, Mr. Collins, in what you think of this proposal that the Speaker Madigan has made, this proposal to, if not fire these 3,000 people, at least review their situations and make some determination on whether or not they should keep their job. Do you think that is a good idea?
Well, I honestly, I've read the headlines on the proposal, but I don't know the substance of it. I think to paint everyone with a brush that everyone's crooked, if that's the sort of concept that everybody is out, I think that's, you know, that's overstated. And I say that as someone, my understanding is the Ryan appointees are included in that.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, I don't come from the position that everybody in state government is crooked. In fact, just the opposite. I believe there's many good and decent people in state government, but their leaders, the managers of state government, the people that are in these rutan exempt positions, you know, sometimes play too much politics. I fully agree that, you know, boards and commissions should be vetted. There are appointments there that are suspect because of contributions and other decisions. And, you know, it's Governor Quinn's, you know, prerogative to have, you know, the people serve for him. And I think he should. And my understanding is sort of taking a look at those positions. So, I mean, I think you gotta focus on where, you know, where things are broken. And, you know, we came, for example, in our work, we heard a lot about the State Board of Elections. And, again, I think there's some good and decent people on the State Board, so it's not a personal attack on them. But I think there's, you know, there are some structural elements of some of these boards that aren't functioning as well as they should. And I think that's where the focus should be. So, I mean, to me, there's, you know, there should be a very comprehensive, detailed, thorough review of, you know, is this board, is this commission serving a purpose? I mean, one of our commissioners, Pam Davis, you know, has made some very strong statements about the Healthcare Facilities Planning Board, which was at the core of this whole RESCO mess. And there's been some legislation proposed about, you know, that whole board, as I understand it, was fired, and there's going to be some new appointments there. I mean, certainly where there's been scandal and where there's been problems and where boards aren't functioning structurally well, you know, they should definitely get a hard look, and it's, you know, under the governor's jurisdiction to do that. But a statement that just, you know, sort of starts with the presumption that these guys should all be fired, guys and women. You know, some of those positions, as I understand it, are some very sort of mission-critical positions, and I don't think anybody who has a Ryan appointment or Blagojevich appointment by their name should be have a scarlet letter with them. So.
All right. Well, I appreciate the comment of the caller. I have somebody who's here on a cell phone, so I want to get to them. They're next, and this is line one. Hello.
Yeah, good morning.
Mm-hmm.
I just wanted to know if you thought that Illinois government was open and accessible enough to the citizenry of Illinois. I think one of the recommendations in your report was that perhaps more stuff should be put on the Internet or maybe other kinds of information that isn't already available. But if you could elaborate on that, I'd appreciate listening.
All right.
Yeah, I'll be very brief and I'll turn over to Lawrence. But the short answer to this question is no, Illinois government is not open and accessible to its citizens, and that's wrong, and it should be remedied. And one of the first actions we took as a commission was to urge Governor Quinn to issue an executive order to his, you know, the 170,000 employees underneath him that, you know, the presumption in these Freedom of Information Act or FOIA requests, the presumption is that these that requests and information sought is public information. You know, of course, there's privacy concerns and there's some narrow exceptions, but, you know, we've gotten to a point where when you approach your government for information, they look for reasons not to give it to you rather than the presumption that this is your information. And the caller mentioned technology. I mean, to me, that is a, you know, a huge opportunity here. In other words, it shouldn't be that someone has to ask for the information. It should be that the information is posted. Contracts are up on the Internet so that the citizenry can click on the button and get information they want. There's just no, in the long run, it's going to be cheaper. You know, you can go to the copier, put it in a drawer, or you can put it on the Internet. You know, we have this website that we sort of started from scratch, and, you know, when we got materials that were relevant to what we were talking about, we put it up on the Internet. It's not that hard to do, and that should be the presumption. And I think part of it is a new attitude, and I think Governor Quinn, immediately upon our letter, he sent out a directive to his folks, and I do think there's a sense of more sunshine under Governor Quinn. But, you know, governments across the state have to have their feet held to the fire, and they have to understand that this information is the people's information. It's not their personal information.
All right. Mr. Oliver, you want to add something?
Yeah, I mean, I think, you know, just kind of more specifically, I think people have been denying, you know, valid, legitimate requests for public records with no recourse. And one of the things that we are recommending is that for certain unjustified denials, that there be some penalties attached. There needs to be the right incentive to comply with the law. I mean, the law needs to be tweaked in some areas, but I mean, there's enough there now that we're of the mind that it hasn't been applied in the best interest of the public. So we need to incentivize public officials to do that.
All right. Next caller is Champaign County, here where we are, line 3. Hello.
Hi. I don't know if your news crew is reporting on power outages, but I've been inconvenienced by at least one. I don't know if it's regional or district or just an individual building. But anyway, the easy solution of term limits seems to be it's an easy one, but I don't think it really works. The real reason why the big four have the power is because of the lack of limits of financial donations, and it seems we need some kind of hybrid public-private matching sort of thing with limits, which would solve the problem of a lot of donors. As long as the big four can have these war chests and be more beholden, representatives more beholden to them, and that's true of any major donors. So it seems to me that that's really where to look at. As far as this culture of Chicago infecting Springfield, I think Springfield had a very highly developed culture of lobbying and corruption parallel to Chicago. So I think that's a bit of South Illinois or Central Illinois provincialism that we should point out. It was a combination of William Cellini, I guess, who had been Sangamon County's Republican chairman, with Rezko, that are up in the docket with Blagojevich on some kind of shakedown of a Hollywood producer. So there's a lot of avenues for corruption. There was another point, but again, as time is short, I guess I'll have you respond to those. Though the state employees, I mean, if we have a reasonable limit on donations, I think that you wouldn't have to single state employees out as having lost their right to participate in an election process. I'll ring off and listen. Thanks.
Well, I mean, I think the caller's right that, and frankly, just I guess the one point I'll make with regard to the caller is our commission's report took what we call a holistic approach. This idea that if you just do term limits for legislative leaders, you know, it'll solve the problems. No. I mean, you got to look at redistricting. You got to look at campaign limits. You got to get more transparency in government. One thing we haven't really talked about is procurement. In other words, how the state, gives out its goods and services in this pay-to-play environment. I mean, you got to talk about fixes there. And the reality is, and this is something I think, you know, we've been discussing with the General Assembly and would ask folks to think about as they petition their government in the next couple of weeks. You know, you can't just do something here and declare victory in transparency. I mean, you just can't improve FOIA, which we all agree is important, but you can't just say, okay, we did ethics. You got to look at everything, and you got to, one of our commissioners used the concept of trap doors. You know, whenever you do something here, there's going to be a trap door that opens, and you got to address that because you can't just work here and then do term limits and go home and declare victory because, you know, term limits, the empirical evidence on term limits is, you know, it sounds good and it sort of strikes a chord with people who are upset, but empirically, the guys who are term limited out just go to different positions and then come back, and there's sort of this, you know, merry-go-round that gets in, and it doesn't really change the dynamic. So this holistic approach is something I just would ask your listeners to think about when they're talking to their legislators or writing letters or emails, and in turn, when they hear someone claiming, you know, when they're running in 2010, I was for ethics reform because I voted for this. You know, how holistic were you in your approach? I mean, I think that's an important question to be asking.
We just have about 5 minutes left. One thing I wanted to ask is where things stand now. I think as you explained, the recommendations that you have made have to be turned into some sort of legislation for the lawmakers to have anything to vote on. So that, I guess, some of that is going on. I understood that Mr. Collins, you and perhaps some of the other members of the commission had some meetings with John Cullerton, president of the Illinois State Senate, and there was a report, at least I think I read this on the website of the Chicago Tribune, that there might be something for senators, at least, actually to vote on the beginning of next week. What do you know about that?
Well, and you'd have to direct that to Senate President Culverton's staff, who I read the same comment. And look, here's what I know, and I don't pretend to know everything. Of our six prongs, we actually got bills back from the Legislative Review Bureau, LRB, that writes the bills. We got those back last night. We've sent them to leadership this morning. We have these five other segments that as soon as we get these bills, we're sending them out the door. It's absolutely a fair point that the bills have to be there for folks to sort of digest them, and the devil's in the details on these things. So I do expect by the end of the week we will have all our concepts into bills. We are simultaneously talking to leadership, and frankly, either side of the aisle, whoever wants to talk with us about our ideas, we will talk to them. We've been invited. This is the one point that I will say, and this, we said this publicly after we met with Senator Culverton, and he invited us for any bills that we cannot reach agreement on. In other words, if we want the primary to be moved and no one else, Senate and House, won't agree to that, they will allow us to present that concept before that bill, before the Senate Executive Committee. And we've been told that that could happen as early as Monday. Look, there's only a couple weeks left, so the stuff's got to happen in the next couple weeks. We're sort of in overtime. We sort of thought our work was done with the report, but it's pretty clear it's not. We're happy to be ambassadors for this thing, and we appreciate Senator Culverton, Senator Redonio's outreach. And our focus is on the Senate because that's where our bills are. But obviously there's two houses, and there's a lot to be done in the next couple of weeks. So what I understand, just to summarize, is we're getting our bills in the hopper this week, and we may well appear next week, whether it's Monday or another day, to sort of make our pitch to on specific topics, particularly those that aren't getting agreement in the General Assembly.
Well, let me ask you this question. It's a delicate one, and it would not surprise me. I would forgive you for not wanting to answer it. Do you think that there is more interest in your work, your recommendations, and reform in the Senate than in the House?
I mean, the short answer is no. I mean, I think there's folks in both chambers that are willing, and we have been negotiating with Speaker Madigan's folks on the procurement piece of our six-legged stool, so to speak. I'm not going to judge anything. I mean, ask me those questions after this is over. But, right now we're moving on all cylinders. There is, you have to start a bill in one place. And, Senator Culverton has given us these vehicles. We've had a meeting with him. We've talked to Senator Redonio. We're progressing at pace. We do have open lines of communication with House Minority Leader Cross and Speaker Madigan's office on procurement. So, we're playing the game, and we have a standard, and at the end of the day, we want to be as close to our standard as possible. And this is no time to sort of suggest blame, because there's no blame to be had right now. People are focusing on this issue, and I would just give one last pitch to your callers to really, whatever their views are, to make it be known. Because what I have been told is, when legislators hear from 12 or 15 people on the same issue, they think there's a revolution afoot.
Yeah.
And, I think that's, frankly, not a very strong statement about our democracy. And I really think the phone lines and the email lines should be lit up. Because this is, to me, we went through the impeachment, we went through the embarrassment. This is, in some respects, so much more important to that, because this is about fixing it. And we don't agree with everybody, including the governor, on our proposals. But there's a solid agreement on some core issues. And I really think it's those issues that folks should let their legislators know about it.
Yeah. I want to turn to Lawrence Oliver. I know that I heard Mr. Conlon say something to the effect that he certainly hoped that this report wouldn't simply be one of those reports that that gets made and then gets put on a shelf.
Yes.
And I'm certain that you would agree with that sentiment, that you and all members of the committee want to see the lawmakers actually take action in these areas. Given the difficulties, would you say that you are optimistic about at least some of your recommendations becoming law?
I am optimistic, without being naive. As I mentioned, I worked served on the Illinois Executive Ethics Commission for 4 years, and throughout that time, we tried a few times at least to get amendments to the Ethics Act, which would have created greater transparency in terms of the work the inspectors general do and some other aspects of the act. And we were unsuccessful during my time. And I was somewhat discouraged because a lot of our proposals never even got a vote, which is essentially what we're seeking now. So, you know, I've seen the difficulties, but yet I realize that this time that we're in is unlike any other time. And because of that, I feel more optimistic than ever. Will we get everything in the next 3 weeks? You know, that I would be thrilled. If we don't get everything in the next 3 weeks, I would not be surprised. But our goal is to keep all of these issues on the front burner and to make sure that they don't die without good faith consideration by the General Assembly.
Well, I suppose that would be people of a cynical bent would say that would be the risk. That is, that the General Assembly would pick through these things and find the things that they find least objectionable, pass them, and then say, "Okay, we've done it." If something like that should happen, do you think that you all, or there are at least people who are in the position to continue to say, "Look, we think this is important. We think more should be done," and continue to kind of poke the General Assembly and to try to keep them on the case?
Yeah, I mean, I suspect we'll continue to talk as long as people listen. I mean, Patrick Collins has been, I mean, he's essentially been sold out on this effort since January. I mean, he's given everything and essentially put his private practice temporarily on the side, and it's probably only so much more he can do. But collectively, sure, we're here. I mean, our 100-day mandate is over, but we obviously are staying engaged, and we'll continue to do that.
Yeah, I mean, to me, if you look at it just numerically, if you look at our report and you say, you know, that's a 10 by our standard, and you know, the folks who don't want reform are at a 2 or 3. You know, if we wind up at a 3 or 4, you know, it's going to be a huge disappointment, and I think we'll say so as a group. You know, if we're at 7 or 8 and moving in the right direction, I mean, that's something different. And I think it's very much an open question right now whether we're going to be at a 7, 8, or 9 or 2, 3, or 4. I really do believe it's that wide a gap where we could be in a good case and bad case scenario. And I think, frankly, the difference will be, and one of the reasons I, you know, take time out to do calls like this is, I think the only thing that's going to be the difference is the public, and the public and the media sort of as a surrogate for the public. Do people care enough about this issue to make it a big deal, to write, to email? That's the difference. And frankly, you know, and I hope this doesn't sound the wrong way, but if people don't care enough, then, you know what, if we get a 2 or 3, then that's what we should get, because that's what we deserve.
Well, there we must stop. Our guests, Patrick Collins, Lawrence Oliver, are two members of the Illinois Reform Commission. They, in late April, released the final recommendations of their 100-day effort to look at problems with Illinois politics and suggest changes. And if you'd like to read their proposals, go to that website that I mentioned a couple of times, www.reformillinoisnow.org. Mr. Collins, thank you very much.
Enjoyed it. Thanks for having me.
And Mr. Oliver, thank you.
You're welcome, David.
Before we go, we just want to mention that support for our program, Focus 580, comes from the Infant Parent Institute. Celebrating its 20th anniversary in Champaign, the Infant Parent Institute is a private clinical practice and research institute dedicated to supporting the mental health of young children and their families. Information on the web at infantparent.com. We're broadcasting from Campbell Hall for public telecommunication, thanks to a generous gift from Robert and Alice Campbell. That's it for us here on Focus. We want you to stay tuned. Up next, the Afternoon Magazine, a lot of other things, news, features, and I'm sure more talk about the weather. The host for the show, Celeste Quinn.
Thank you very much, David. Indeed, we will talk about the weather. Mike Sola will be with us at 12:35 with the forecast. Then in the 1 o'clock hour of the program today, we'll talk with Mark Sloan. He's a pediatrician and he's the author of Birthday. A pediatrician explores the science, the history, and the wonder of childbirth. That follows the 1 o'clock news. Let's take a look now at commodity prices in Kansas City. May wheat, 640, up 6. July, 638 and a quarter, up 3 quarters. Chicago May wheat, 580 and 3 quarters, down 1 and 3 quarters. July, 589, down 3 and 3 quarters. May corn, 420, up 1 half. July, 427, down 1 half. September, 436 and a half, up 1 quarter. December, 447 and 3 quarters, down 1 quarter. May beans, 1142 and a half, up 5. July, 1121 and 3 quarters, up 4 and a quarter. August, 1079 and a quarter, up 4 and a quarter. September, 1026 and 3 quarters, up 3 and a quarter. And November, 978 and 3 quarters, down 3 quarters.